Hello, my name is Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here. And thank you, Harlan and Zan, for inviting me. And thank you particularly for allowing me to bring a guest. I'm traveling with my son, who's 16 years old, and I've been traveling a little bit lately, and it's just a pleasure to have this time away with him. It's nice to have someone who's 6'2" follow you around and point out all your flaws constantly all day long. And sometimes when I travel by myself, I don't get the benefit of that. And it's a good thing. And but it's a pleasure. It's humbling to be here with the group. I know a lot of the people who are speaking this weekend. I've become fast friends with Rich and Lauren really over this year. I've got a chance to hang out with Charlie at the my sponsor's house and drive him to the airport after a retreat. I finally got to meet his wife, and Tom came from the airport with me. It's just been a pleasure. The Al-Anon speakers, I've been to every meeting so far, and it's humbling to come here, you know, and it's neat to see how different people do it. There's a lot of energy here, a lot of energy of recovery, and I particularly like the cutoffs that occasionally faint during the talks. And I don't know if anybody else noticed this, and I don't want to disillusion anybody, but those are not the bodies of our founders, you know. Bob was not a triathlete, and he and Bill didn't have matching suits. But I will tell you that if it was not an AA or an Al-Anon who put those bodies on those heads or photoshopped that, it's somebody who had some insight, because the Al-Anons are standing like this. And I thought that was beautiful. I've been thinking, sometimes the universe just converges and things work out. But my sobriety date's May 16th, 1993, and my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. It meets on Monday nights. And thanks. Yeah, like Charlie said, you're applauding for the power greater than me. And anyone who's a male alcoholic is welcome to our meeting on Monday nights. And there's a women's group that meets right behind us. And I always feel kind of challenged. I always have great hopes. I'm Irish Catholic. I'm full of hope. I believe the glass is always half full. And I wish that I could come up here and do this and tell you what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always give a little disclaimer that I know that I will fail at that. But I can tell you the steps I took and the effect they had on me and the influence of the men of Alcoholics Anonymous and the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I know that I'm not going to succeed. Because there's been great things that have happened on the outside of my life. There's the story, but there's these subtle things, there's sort of richness inside me that I didn't know I could experience. And that has never stopped developing and growing in 20 years of being in this program. And it's just very, very hard to articulate. So my hope is that I'll speak a little bit about what Charlie brought up, is that we should talk about how we've developed a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And I took that today when I went back to my room and thought, I hope I can do that tonight. I hope I can at least deliver that to you tonight. So with that in mind, I don't want to waste a lot of time on my drinking. It's always also a little bit intimidating to have a 8-foot version of myself right next to me. I was in Rochester, New York, and the camera was zoomed in on the speaker's head, so we all looked like the great and powerful Oz. And people wait in line to talk to you, and it's very touching. Sometimes they share some beautiful stories. It's actually one of my favorite parts. And at the very end, this little old lady came up to me and said, "I just needed to tell you, you've got the most beautiful teeth." Because they were 3 feet tall. I'm so glad for those braces. But you know, May 16th, 1993 is my sobriety date, and May 1st, things weren't going so well. I try to kind of crunch this down. I want you to trust that I'm alcoholic, but I really want to talk about recovery. And on May 1st, you know, I weighed 108 pounds. On May 1st, I had been fired from the last job that was beneath me about 6 months before that. Remember that? The job's so lame, you can barely stand taking it, and then they fire you, and you're shocked. And that happened to me. And on May 1st, I was sitting on my couch holding my breath when the mailman came up on the porch, because I didn't know who that was. And I didn't want anyone to know I was in there. The mail was all angry mail, you know, when your mail starts to turn red. Final notice, and like all this kind of rude mail. And rude mail stays outside. That was a rule in my bachelor pad. And my parents were, like, I've loved to hear what the people said about their families. My mother and father, too, were lovely people. They were hardworking Irish Catholic people. I always say my alcoholism is not their fault. My Irish Catholicness, they have a lot of explaining to do. That is their fault. That runs deep. But they were great. They were married for 50 years. You know, my dad was an insurance salesman, much against his will. He wanted to be something else, but he wanted to support us. And my mother was a school teacher. And they just had this beautiful life. They loved each other. And they were living a couple miles away from me on May 1st, 1993. And my mother was terminally ill with cancer. And I used to call her up. I didn't normally go to sleep during that time, but I'd call her up in a moment of clarity, because I love my mother. I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family, which is, if you're Irish Catholic, you know, that's a relatively small family. But I was the youngest by 7 years. I'm all for the Pope not condoning birth control. I'm selfish and self-centered. But it's why I'm here, is because Catholics don't, my parents took that seriously, didn't believe in birth control, and I was a shock, not a surprise. But they lived, we were really close, my mom and dad and I, partly because my brothers and sisters kind of went off to college and I got a lot of time with them, getting to know them in their later years. And, you know, we'd been through a lot. My brother was a terrible, terrible alcoholic. He was the next one up for me, 7 years older than me. And he was my hero. You know, he played the drums. He looked like Paul McCartney. I thought he was a god. But from the time he was 14 or 15 on, he was a raging alcoholic. And what that looked like in my house is, I had to hide my paper route money because he would steal it. And he was such a well-known thief in our house that my parents made it seem like it was my fault. That they're like, he's a thief. You left your money out? You know. What are you thinking? And I was a pretty serious Catholic, so I hollowed out my Bible and I put my money in there because nobody looked in there in my family. Figured it was safe. I remember once he sold my surfboard at a garage sale. And he didn't even blink. He needed money, you know. But I loved him, and he wreaked havoc. And I could tell that what he needed to do was stop drinking, and he didn't think so. But none of that mattered on May 1st, 1993. On May 1st, 1993, I had drank away my character. You know, I graduated with honors with 2 degrees from college. I went on the road with a rock and roll band. I played lead guitar all over the country. I graduated from college to make my parents happy, and I went on the road with a rock and roll band to make me happy. And if there's nothing else that I say tonight to convince you that I'm an alcoholic, pay strict attention to the next sentence. I was kicked out of a rock and roll band for drinking too much. That's very, very hard to do. The bar is very low. The standards are low. But they were a good band. We were making money and making albums, and we needed serious people. And if you're not standing there when the lights come on in the other town because you met some nice people in the town before that, that's a problem. And I was a problem, you know. And I'd come back, and I got this job. I came back and lied. I told everybody in L.A. that I came back from the East Coast because my mother had cancer. You know, and it was a convenient truth that she had cancer. And it was my lack of character that used that as an excuse to cover up the fact that I drank my dream away. Because I couldn't tell anybody that. I got a job at a restaurant. I was a waiter for about 5 minutes. And I remember thinking, it's okay to be a waiter, Matthew, because then you're kind of still an artist. You're kind of waiting for your next move, you know. I'm going to make a comeback album. You know, come back from where? And that wasn't the job that was beneath me. It was when they looked at my resume, they said, hey, you went to college, and you know, you want to be the manager of this restaurant? And I did not want to be the manager because that was lame, and I was about cool. But they said, you know, it was more money, and I needed money. I owed everybody money, and I had warrants out for my arrest, and lots of bad people were after me, and I thought, okay, I'll be a manager. And they're taking me around, and I couldn't be less excited about this job. I just couldn't. I did not want to do it. And they're going, okay, so here's the schedule for when the meat's delivered, and here's how you do the books, and here are the waitresses' phone numbers, which that kind of interested me. And I was 31, and they were all 18. 18, so it was nice to be promoted out of their waitress pool into management. And then they said, and here are the keys to the bar. And suddenly I felt like my whole life had sort of been geared towards developing to be good at this job. And I thought, you know, I can do this. I got the keys to the bar. And it was like, bah! You know, and Excalibur. And the way I managed that restaurant is I would hover over. They used to have these people that would come in called customers, and they really made everything a pain in the ass. And I would hover over these customers so they'd leave, right? Because I wanted to get the waitresses up to the bar. And I did that, and the idea was to go home with one of the waitresses, or maybe more than one of the waitresses. I always aimed high. I was a rock and roll musician. And you know, a lot of times they'd come up to me and say, hey, you know, it's 2 a.m, and we just got an apartment together, and we've got a hot tub. Do you want to come over? And I'd be like, why would we leave here? You know, I had this unlimited amount. Because once I start drinking, everything else doesn't matter anymore. Whatever my plan was didn't matter anymore. I never planned to drink my life away. I didn't plan to drink my dream away. You know how many people want to get the job that I got? And I blew it. And I laugh about it. And when I laugh about it, I feel a pain in my heart. Because I practiced all my life for it. I had a God-given talent to do it. I loved it. And it didn't matter once I started drinking. And these girls didn't matter once I started drinking. And I did occasionally go home with a girl. And one day they fired me from that lame job. And I remember I was stunned. Even though I had been the worst restaurant manager in the history of restaurant management. And they fired me, and as I'm walking downstairs, this waitress stops me, and she's got this really weird look on her face, and she says, I'm pregnant. That's what I said. I just said it with so much more depth and feeling than you said it. And I'm about to alienate all the women, and I'm used to it. I mean, I'm an AA speaker. I'm not running for president. When you judge me, I'm like, seriously? So, yeah. Why you invited me? I was a really good guy, and then I stopped drinking. But if you lined up the waitresses at Marie Callender's and said, which one of them do you want to get pregnant? I would have said, not her. I know, sorry, I'm a scumbag, news. But truly, I tell you that because I was selfish and self-centered to such an extreme that I thought she was selfish and self-centered. She was 18. I was 31. And I just changed her life forever. I used to say, she got pregnant. And my sponsor would say, you had a part in that. You need to say, when I got her pregnant. And I was so demoralized and scared. I had this great example of my family that I went out. I stormed out of that restaurant and walked into the employee parking lot pretending that my car was there. I didn't know where my car was. I hadn't seen it in a long time. But I had a key. So there must be a car. And I carried the key around because I'm a hopeful, glasses half full kind of guy. And I went around to the bus stop. This is a true story. I sometimes offend people. This is just the facts of my life. This is just what happened. I walked around and to a bus stop. I kind of snuck around the bus stop when I got fired. I had snot coming out of my nose. I was crying. I got this girl pregnant. I got fired from this crappy job. I can't stop drinking. I'm shaking all the time. I haven't gone to visit my mother. I wanted to visit my mother. I'd call my mother and say, I'm coming to visit you, and believe I was going to go, and then I'd have a drink, and I didn't go. And I'm walking to this bus stop with all of this angst and self-loathing and fear and guilt. And it's really kind of like, I can't believe it. I can't believe this happened. I walk up to the bus stop, and this is right in front of the Alano Club in Hermosa Beach. And right next door is a civic center where they taught. One of the things they did there is they had classes for young, mentally retarded young adults who were being taught how to live on their own, how to pay their bills, and how to cook and clean and stuff. And they would all get out at one time, and I'd seen them before because I managed a restaurant right across the street. So I walk up, and there's about 9 or 10 of these young adults who are mentally retarded standing at the corner, and I'm standing there with my Marie Callender's badge on, and I got snot coming out of my nose, and I'm trying not to cry, and I step onto Pacific Coast Highway to see when the bus is going to come, and 10 mentally retarded people yell, don't stand in the tree! Don't stand in the tree! And they scared the hell out of me. And I jumped back on. I thought they saw a bus, you know. And because I did drugs. And I saw things that weren't there. I had rested my hand once on a police car that was in my living room. So that was a sad day because I knew I couldn't trust my brain anymore. And so I thought the bus was coming, and there was no bus coming. And then I stood up there and had that second breath after that happened to go, I have 2 degrees, and these people are better at waiting for a bus than I am. They're more talented at it. And I got on the bus, and I went home to drink myself to death. And in the middle of the night, sometimes I'd pull a gun out. My roommate, who was gone for a long time, he's gone for several months while I disintegrated, he had a gun. And I would put hollow point bullets in his gun and put it in my mouth and pray for courage. Because I didn't want to be that kind of son anymore. I certainly wasn't ready to be a father. I was becoming something that I didn't recognize. And it was when I started drinking, it started. And when I wake up in the morning, I didn't want to drink. And Charlie talked about it, you know. I live right next to the ocean. I lived on Avenue A in Catalina in Redondo Beach, which is right next to the ocean. In fact, I was so close to the ocean at night, I would wander around in my apartment and go, what is that noise? And because it's a constant sound. That's true. I actually would oil my screen door because I assumed it was blowing or something. But I would wake up in the morning and say, Matthew, get a job today. And I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to anymore because I couldn't pull out. I couldn't pull out of this. Don't drink. Don't call the guys who come over with the stuff. Go see this girl's parents and tell them that you're going to do the stand-up thing. Go see your mom. Don't drink. Don't drink. And I might as well have said, hold back the Pacific Ocean. Because I had no power over that. I didn't know that, but I've been working with alcoholics now for a long time, and I see the powerlessness, and I recognize what was happening to me. But I didn't know that, because I could always make it happen in the last minute. I always did well in college in the last minute. I always showed up for the recording session at the last minute with the new material. I always did what I needed to do, and I couldn't do it anymore, and I couldn't do it anymore. And I was becoming this guy that I didn't even know. You know, my parents were married for 50 years to each other. They were madly in love with each other. I never saw my father scream at my mother. They weren't that kind of people. My dad was this gregarious Irish Catholic guy. He told great stories. He loved us openly and unabashedly. He loved my mother like she was a goddess. And my mother was this quiet woman of dignity who just made me feel secure and safe all the time. And that's the example I had. That's what I grew up with. And I pushed that girl, that teenage girl, down a flight of stairs when she was 8 months pregnant. And that's what I became. And I didn't want to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt the baby. I just wanted her to stop telling me to not drink that day. And she was standing in the door. I wanted her out of the door, and I pushed her out, and I knew I pushed her too hard. And I closed the door, and I went inside, and I had a drink. And that's what it was like. And I didn't know how I had become this. And I didn't want to be it anymore. And I couldn't stop. So the gun seemed like a good idea. And then about May 13th to 14th that year was Mother's Day. And it recently occurred to me, because I got to be an Akron at Founders Day, that Mother's Day is right around the time that Bill met Bob. But my brother, my black sheep brother, who was the drummer and the alcoholic who stole my paper route money, was sober at that time for 12 years. And he called me and he said, hey, I know you're having car trouble. Because Irish Catholic people don't like to embarrass each other. And if you have a key and no car, that's car trouble. We don't want to pry. You don't need to explain. We've had keys with no cars before. And it's Mother's Day, and it's probably Mom's last Mother's Day, and I want to come take you. I want to make sure you come. And I thought, why would he think I'm not going to come? And I was pissed at him already. I was indignant. I'd forgotten that I'd called my mother 25 times and said, hey, Mom, I'm going to come visit you today. And she always said the same thing. She always said, that would be lovely, darling. And I never went. And I wanted to go. I'd hang up the phone, start walking towards the door and go, man, I'm skinny. I don't want to explain about the job. I don't really know where the car is. I'll just go next door. I live right next door to a liquor store. I'll get a beer, sit here, get a little bit of courage, and go do it. And I never went. So my brother said, we want to make sure you show up. I didn't know what he was talking about. And then he showed up, and I met him outside. Because, you know, you have those moments. I heard this woman, I can't remember her name. We were in somewhere on the East Coast, and she said, you know, if alcohol took your life in one bite, we'd just come to AA. Everybody would come to AA. It would be so devastating. But alcohol takes a little bite, and you adjust. Then it takes another bite, and you adjust. And then it takes another bite. And pretty soon, you're living in squalor, and you don't even know it. It's acceptable. And I looked around my apartment when my brother, my sober brother, was coming over. And suddenly it seemed kind of strange. You know, most people don't have bottles on the floor. And I had these things, I don't know if you guys have them here, but they were SWAT-proof blankets on the windows. They were for the SWAT teams and who were all conspiring to get the punk in my apartment. You know, and I had dishes in the sink from the Reagan administration. You know, I was a bachelor. And so I went outside to meet him outside, and I didn't take a shower. I'd been up all night drinking. I combed my hair and put a clean shirt on. I looked terrible, and I didn't know I weighed 108 pounds. And I walked up, and he looked at me, and his eyes got really big, and he got kind of quiet. And we drove down. Nobody had seen me for months. And we went down to Mother's Day at this little yacht club in Redondo Beach where they're having a brunch. And my dad was all nervous because my mom was dying, and my dad would tell a lot of jokes when he was nervous. And then he saw me, and things kind of went sideways, and I don't really know what happened, but I understand that I really, really made a mess of it. And I really said some unbelievable things, and I didn't know what I was saying. And my brother took me home, and mercifully, and on the way home, we got in a fight, an argument, and I got out of the car and slammed his door, and I ran to my apartment. And I was so sick of him being right about everything. I was so sick of him being better than me and smarter than me. And they used to say to me when I was a kid, you're going through a stage. And I'd be like, well, the only reason you know that is because you went through a stage when you were my age, and that would reason out to mean you're going through a stage right now too. And someday I will reach that stage, and you'll still be infuriatingly telling me you're going through a stage. So I kind of grew, I had a little chip on my shoulder about being the youngest, and I just was so mad at him that he was talking down to me. And we don't know what the fight was about. It wasn't about my appearance. I don't know if it was about something I said. But I waited till he got home, and I waited, and I paced around, because he lived quite a ways from me, and I called him up on the phone, and I let him have it. I just let him have it. I just unloaded all my angst. I had lined up my arguments. I was going to tell him. I was going to win this argument, and I just went off on him. I don't know what I said. We neither of us remembers what we were fighting about. You know, I don't know if there's any other Irish Catholics here. My suspicion is there are a couple. So you'll know what I mean. Irish people, there's one in the back. Good to see you. Hello. And they're like if swans on a lake. You know, if you ever see swans on a lake, that's how Irish families fight. You know, they're cruising along. They bump into each other. Wah, 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 wah. Okay, see you at Thanksgiving. Like, no biggie. We fight, we forget, we fight again. It's not like we hold on to things. And I got done yelling at my brother. And I was standing there, and I remember this moment, because this was a moment of grace. It's actually a moment that this whole conference is about. I screamed at my brother, and I'm standing there, and this moment of grace happened. And what happened was my brother said, Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. That was not the moment of grace. I had heard that before. I'd heard that. I was engaged once for about 6 days, and the father of my bride kind of talked to me about that, and the manager of the band talked to me about that, and the band, when they kicked me out, talked to me about that. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic, man. My brother was an alcoholic. He lived in his car. And my brother said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And all those days after days after days of, I don't want to drink anymore. I want to get a job today. I don't want to be this terrible man anymore. I'm abusing a pregnant girl. I'm a secret. Everything I do is a secret. I've committed crimes. I've let things be done to me that I didn't expect I'd ever let be done to me. I've done things to people I never expected I'd do to anybody. It all just came to the foreground. And I said, this is the moment of grace. I said, of course I do. And it was my jumping off point. And I didn't even know it. But I remember it. I can tell you what the carpet looked like. I can tell you what the dust looked like coming through the Venetian blinds. I can tell you where the bottles were on the floor. I was standing up, and I had an old rotary phone. and the cord was stretched to my face, and I all I can think of, the reason I remember this so well is because just for a minute, even less than a minute, I was in the present moment, and I hadn't been there in years. And I was fully present. And my brother, God bless my brother, he said, "I'll be right there." He said a funny line. We're naturally funny in my family. And he said a naturally funny thing. He wasn't trying to be clever. He said, "Don't go anywhere." And I was like, "Oh, man, well, okay." I was going to move to that side of the couch in a couple of weeks. But if we got plans, I mean, I'll clear my calendar. And don't go anywhere. What am I going to do? Go here, car. And I sat down on the couch and I got filled with fear. And I wasn't afraid that I'd admit it. I'd done the first step. I admitted. You know, there's a great line in the fifth step about all of the steps in the 12 and 12 go contrary to our instincts. They smash our egos. They diminish our egos. And there's nothing more ego diminishing than the word admitted. It's the beautiful step towards getting me out of the way. And I admitted it. And I sat down on the couch, and my fear wasn't that I'd said it out loud. I'd known it. My fear was, now my brother's going to come over, kick my ass, and I'm never going to drink again. And it was the ass kicking I was not looking forward to. Because I thought that's what he might do. I didn't know what AA was. I wasn't even curious about it. All I knew is it gave me my brother back. I didn't know what that was. And in my family, sometimes my brother would hit me. He wasn't a bad brother. He just was learning tool. And I remember one time when he was stealing my paper route money, he asked if he could borrow my bike. And I said, no, because he would sell it or something, right? And I said, no, you can't borrow my bike. And then a neighbor asked if he could borrow my bike to do his paper route. And I said, yeah. And my brother saw the neighbor go buy my bike. And he came into my bedroom and beat me up going, "Family comes first." And I learned that lesson. Not too much. But you know, I just... He said, "I'm going to be there," and I thought he was going to hurt me. And you know what? I was so dirty on the inside that I kind of hoped he would. I kind of hoped someone would beat me up, beat me till I couldn't breathe anymore, because I just couldn't stand it anymore. And he showed up in my door faster than should have been physically possible for him to get there. It was way too fast. And I know he was at home because I called him at home. And I got sober BC before cell phones. And he shows up at my door, and I'm stunned. And now I know why he did. Because my brother's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he saw that window of willingness. And he wanted to get to me before I changed my mind. And he came through the door, and he inhaled, and he said, "Let's go to the beach." And I remember I grabbed a pack and a half of Marlboro Reds, and I don't know why I always say that, but I just remember that. And I went down to this lifeguard stand on Avenue A and sat there, and I was so afraid of what he was about to say. I thought he was going to humiliate me or thump me on the chest or hurt me, and he didn't. He just looked so sort of, he was thinking, and he looked at me for a while, and he thought, and he looked over my head for a long while, and then he started talking to me about how he felt when my mom and dad kicked him out of our house when he was 18. And I remember that day because it was the lowest moment of our family history. And I was 11. And then he started talking to me about how he felt when his wife and son kicked him out of their house. And I remember that day because he called me. He had no one left to call. He called his little brother, and I was about 14 years old, and he sobbed. And I said, "You need to quit drinking." And he said, "You don't understand." And then he started talking to me about how he felt when he lived in his car. And I was really curious about that time in his life because I remember when he lived in his car. I was 16 years old when my brother lived in his car. And I used to take my dad's car to school sometimes when I've had band practice or something. And I'd drive around to find my brother on my way to school. And if I saw his car, he was sometimes parked behind a school. Sometimes he parked behind a grocery store. I'd pull up and look inside. And if he breathed, if he was in there, sometimes he wasn't in there. If he breathed, I'd go because I was just afraid he was going to die in the street. And right in the middle of all that, my brother's looking right at me. He's telling me this, and he starts describing how I'm feeling sitting on that lifeguard stand by telling me how he felt when he lived in his car. And
it just did something to me. It disarmed me because I didn't think there was anyone on earth who knew how I felt. I didn't think anybody hated themselves as much as I did, yet was as self-centered as I was. I didn't think anybody felt as grandiose and as small at the same time. And my brother's a super articulate man. And he laid it out, and he won my confidence. And if you're wondering where he figured this out, I thought he was this wise Buddha. Turns out there's a chapter in this blue book called Working with Others. And I want to point something out, because I've heard some stuff at this conference, and I'm not trying to debate with anybody. But it never says in the big book, we thumped the new guy on the chest and called him stupid. In fact, it says that will be ineffectual in helping an alcoholic. It says we never talk down to an alcoholic. And my brother saw a suffering man, and he did exactly what it says. He told me a little bit about his own story, and it won my confidence. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Because he caught me when I jumped off. He knew exactly what to do because he came here and he did the work that Charlie talked about. He was a hardcore trudger, book-thumping son of a gun. And then I looked at him and I gave up. I surrendered. And I'd love to tell you I had this moment of clarity, but I actually ran out of cigarettes. And, you know, I got to go now. I'm out of cigarettes. And it's been fun. But I threw up my arms and I said, you know what, man, you're right, I got to go to AA. And he kind of focused and he started laughing. And the Buddha disappeared. And my sarcastic brother showed up. And he goes, dude, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I looked at him and said, well, how long do I can't, what? And he said, yeah, you're going. I go, how long is that? And he goes, 28 days. And I go, man, I can't do that. I'm busy. I'm busy. I haven't left my couch for 6 months. I haven't paid a bill. And I jokingly talk about this, but what was I thinking? Like, who's not going to pay my bills? I'm the guy not paying my bills right now. You know? Anybody else busy? Yeah. Who's not going to answer the phone? I don't answer that phone. That is my particular duty. And then we walked up to the house, and he said, he looked at me as I was walking in, and I was fumbling with my keys, which still cracks me up because I didn't lock the door. And he looks up at me, and he goes, don't die. And I felt so embarrassed because I thought he knew about the gun. And in my family, you don't kill yourself. You're a Mitchell. We're good people. We go to college. We further people. We help people. My father was like an amazing man, World War II vet. He used to visit the sick. He visited sick people he didn't like because that's what his faith told him to do. And it would have devastated my family if I shot myself. And he said, don't die. And he later told me, I thought you were going to die. You didn't know what I weighed, but went to a hospital. I weighed 108 pounds. I'm 5'10 and a half. When you're 5'10, you add the half. And and I'm not, I'm not close to 108 anymore. He thought I was dying, and he hurried. And on May 16th, 1993, the phone rang. I jumped up to get it. I thought I was going to the hospital, and it was somebody on the other end who said, your daughter was born. I've been trying to reach you. And I had passed out face down on the carpet because on May 15th, I got ready for rehab. I'm not a slacker. I sold some things and bought some stuff. And it wasn't him. So I ran out to go see my daughter at this hospital. And I love to tell this story because I read the big book a lot with newcomers and usually get about as far to the place where it says alcoholism is a disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. And I think this is a beautiful example of my self-centeredness. I got in the car that I found. I found my car. Had a lot of tickets on the front that went in the back with the other tickets. And I went to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies come from. Right? And they weren't there. And I'm slamming my fist down. I look again, My big scary skeletal frame was coming down on this poor volunteer. And Then I went back and put my head on the steering wheel and thought, I'm the biggest loser on earth. Then I remembered where Anna said the baby was going to be born. I drove to that hospital. I run upstairs. I'm running down the hall. I'm not thinking. I'm just doing. I'm running down the hall. I'm not preparing myself. I'm trying to figure out these numbering systems in hospitals. I'm trying to get in this room. I turn into the room, and there's Anna. And she sits up, and she was happy to see me. And I felt worthless and stupid. Now, I don't want to scare Lauren because she's expecting a baby, but if any of you have had a baby or had a woman that's had a baby, after a woman gets done giving birth, particularly after a long labor, they look kind of like a truck hit them. And it's almost like a Picasso, like their eyes are on the wrong sides of their noses. And everything's longer, and it's like sideways. And Anna looked just like that, but she'd never looked more beautiful to me ever. And it scared me. And she got up, and I thought, oh no, she's going to come hug me. And I realized I smell really bad. And she's coming at me. I'm like, no, no. And she stops, and she leans into this rectangular thing, and she pulls out an angel of God named Phoebe Rose. And she puts Phoebe in my arms, and I look at her, and I would love to tell you I felt connected to this girl. I'd love to tell you I saw the miracle of life. Phoebe was beautiful. She was gorgeous. She was innocent and radiant. And she had these blue eyes and this round Irish head. She just was gorgeous. And I felt filthy. Filthy and ugly. I felt like the worst thing on earth. And I couldn't wait to get out of there. And my prayer was, God, I hope that these two women never see me again. Because I'm going to hurt them. And I'm not even going to mean to do it. I had forgotten that I pushed Anna down a flight of stairs because it meant nothing to me. And I just do that. If I'm your friend, I make your life worse. If I'm your lover, I hurt you forever. And I just couldn't stand being me anymore. And I saw these beautiful people, and I felt like they were behind thick glass. And I left with that prayer on my lips, and I went home to the gun, plan B, man. And my brother's sitting on my porch. My brother has this uncanny way of screwing up my plans. And he said, where have you been? I said, my daughter was born. And he didn't say congratulations. He didn't say what's her name. He didn't say is she healthy. He said, get in the car. And he threw me in his car, and he drove me off to a hospital. Scariest day of my life was walking into that hospital. Second scariest day of my life was walking out. 30 days later with a month-old baby, I'm clear-headed. I gained 47 pounds in the hospital. I did. They weigh you on your way in. They weigh you on your way out. Both times the guy went, whoa. Yeah. And so I'd accomplished something. And I got a ride home, and my brother drives me up to my porch, and he says, go to an AA meeting. And I remember thinking, these AA guys are kind of intense. I'm going to an AA. What do you think? I'm nuts? I've got 30 days. I've been in a hospital for 30 days. I've got a mother who's dying of cancer. I got to cure cancer. I got that to do. I got my daughter's 30 days old. I'm terrified of being a father. I got to figure that out. I got to get a job. I got to pay the IRS. I got a lot of things to clear up. I got warrants out for my arrest. And he goes, go to a meeting. Go to a meeting. Like, wow. And I lied. I lie. And I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I had no plans to go to a meeting. And I slam the door of the car, and I walk up to my apartment, and I let myself in, and somebody hands me a beer. Actually, it wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. And I'm holding that thing, and I'm sorry. And there's people snorting cocaine on my glass table, and they're smoking pot in my kitchen. All my favorite Olympic events are happening in there. And I got this beer in my hand, and I stepped backwards, and I put the beer on my porch, and I ran away. And if you're in your first year of sobriety, I want to be really transparent about why I did that. I did not do that because I had a connection to a higher power. I did not do that because I had a foundation of recovery. I did that for two reasons, and only two reasons, and I hope these reasons matter to you. I had a nanosecond to figure this out, and my brain said to me, you've got 30 days of sobriety, Matthew, and that's all you've got in the world. You don't have dignity, self-respect, any financial prospects. Nobody cares about you. Everyone hates you. But you've got 30 days of sobriety. And my second thought was, I'm not throwing it away on those losers. I didn't know if I was going to the liquor store. I couldn't tell you where I was going when I ran away. But I ran to a payphone. A lot of young people in here. They were in rectangular glass, like boxes. Have these doors that... You should Google image it. I can't really describe it to you. They had phones the size of nuclear missiles inside. And Mr. English degree couldn't find AA in the phone book. I looked in the back under embarrassing things you don't want to look up very often. You know, and it's in the front. Surprise, surprise. And I called a guy in AA. This is my favorite part of this whole jumping off point situation. I call this guy and I just throw up. I tell him everything I've told you for the last half hour. Just blah, blah, you know, a rock star, baby. Ah, cancer, of course. Yeah, cocaine. Because I thought this guy was going to help me, and I wanted to fortify him with the facts. And I wanted, you know, I'm a nuanced guy. I'm sensitive. I need really, like, you got to be careful when you're trying to help me. I need help. And I'm just barfing on the guy. And I finally get done, and he goes, where are you? And I said, well, I'm the corner of Burl and Redondo. And he goes, okay, hold on. And I hear that he's flipping through some papers. And he goes, oh, my God, that's so weird. And I go, what? And he said, there's a meeting right across the street from that phone booth, and it starts in 15 minutes. And my response was, what do you think I should do? That's awesome. I'm glad those of you that know each other are getting together. But I'm a stranger here. And I told you my story. We're close now. I need help. And the guy, I wish I'd recorded the way he... I think you should go to the meeting. You know, he thought that's why I called. So I went in there. I was so scared. I was so afraid. I was so afraid I walked around the block. My oldest brother called me 3 years ago. Never got sober in his life. Terrible alcoholic. Genius IQ. And he said, I need help, Matthew. And I said, have you been to a meeting? And he said, I walked around the block. And I got chills. Because I walked around the block. I couldn't go in. I didn't know you and I didn't have my medicine. So I finally went in. I ended up sitting in the middle of this giant speaker meeting in Southern California, of these giant speaker meetings. This one was called Stompers. It's not there anymore because people stomp their feet on the wooden floor instead of clapping. And I'm in the middle, and this guy gets up to the podium. He's got this beautiful suit on. I'm terrified. He's got his hands on the podium. I'll never forget what the guy said. He walked up with all this confidence, and he said, wah, 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. And I'm like, I am so screwed. And I'm looking around, and everybody's laughing and nudging each other, like, ah, you know. And I'm like, really? That's what we do here. And then at one point, he pointed to these things, and out of his mouth came, "These are tools for living." I go, okay. So I can read, you know. So I start looking at the steps. I'm like, why are they in Chinese, man? I need help. Where's the attorney help? You know, send lawyers, guns, and money, Dad. You know, powerless. Ah. And I got up to leave that meeting, and the guy said, hey, you're Neil's little brother. And he said, yeah. And he goes, I heard you look like crap. And I said, that was 30 days ago. And he drove me to my parents' house where I did not want to go. And he dropped me off and drove away. And I did not want to walk up to that door. My mom was dying of cancer. And my perception of what was going to happen is, that house has two honorable, honest people. I am not one of them. They love each other. They've been very good to each other their whole lives. And now one of them is really going to die pretty soon. And my father's beside himself with fear. Their loser son's not showing up on their porch tonight and humiliating them again. It would be awful for them. It would be awful for me. It's the worst possible thing that could happen. That was my perception. But I had nowhere to go. The only other choices were other people's parents' house. And we're not like a lot of escape routes in that neighborhood. So I walk up and I knock on the door, and my parents are from Illinois. They're, you know, good, solid Midwestern people. They come to the door together. And it takes a long time because my mom's struck to an oxygen tank and she's slow. And I'm standing there, I'm going to bolt. I'm going to run away. And they open the door and they're happy to see me. Super happy. And it was, and my dad tried to keep it cool, but the gladness came out of his eyes. And I'm standing there feeling like I'm 3 years old, looking at him and looking at mom, and my mom looks really frail and terrible. And the reality was, my mom and dad were good people. They were honest, hardworking people. They were in love with each other their whole lives. They'd been married for 50 years. My mom was dying of cancer. And the one person that they were laying awake at night worrying about showed up on their porch and said, "Could you help me?" Their dream came true. Their prayer got answered. I've got three kids now, man. Whenever they say, "Dad, I need your help," I feel like I have purpose. And I asked for help when they knew I needed help, and they knew they had to wait for me to ask because they had my brother. And they were so glad, and they took me in, and I moved into my old bedroom, and there's my poster of Eric Clapton that I put up there when I was 13, and he and I got super close in my first year of sobriety. We had long, long talks late into the night. And I would stand by the window blowing cigarette smoke out, standing on my bed with all my dignity. And, you know, I just get up and go to a meeting. I got up in the morning and I wanted to crawl out of my skin in that house. And I said, "Hey, Dad, can I borrow your car? I want to go to a meeting." And he goes, "If you're going to a meeting, Matthew, you can have the car." And I would go find a 6:30 meeting. And you know what? I was just leaving the uncomfortable place. That was my big dedication to sobriety. I wanted to get out of the uncomfortable place. And I had nowhere to go that was safe for me. So I went to the other uncomfortable place, you guys. And it was just a different kind of uncomfortable, you know. Those people knew me. That freaked me out. You don't know me. That freaks me out. They're happy. That's weird. You're happy. That's weird. I go in there and I'd sit in there and I just had these weird experiences. And this is what I wanted to talk to you about, is these weird experiences. I was so self-conscious all the time in my first year of sobriety. If you're new, I know you think we're all looking at you. I know you think we're all talking about you. I have great news. You just landed in the self-centered epicenter of the world. We're looking your direction, but we're thinking about us. What else would we think about? And actually, if someone's looking at you, that means they're working this program, and you're damn lucky they're in that meeting. I remember one of my meetings I went to, it was a men's step study. And the first time I went, I walked up to the coffee pot and I filled up the cup of coffee and I'm looking at everybody talking about me. And I'm not watching the coffee, and it gets to the point of, it has surface tension. That's the only thing that's keeping the coffee from spilling. It says, you know, surface tension, it's too full. And you know, I don't know what it is with AA. It's like McDonald's. We make our coffee like 180 degrees, you know, and you can dance on it. It's really thick. So I turn around, and it's a carpeted room. It's a men's stag step study. The seats are in a circle, and the only chair available is on the far side of the room, and I think it has a bright white spotlight on it. And I'm walking across, and I can't help it because I'm so rigid. The coffee starts spilling on my hand, burning my hand. I'm going, "It's okay. It's fine. It's okay. That don't hurt, man. Seriously." And I sit down, and they start the meeting. And I remember I heard one guy say, "If you haven't worked the step we're talking about, please don't share." And I went, "Oh, awesome." And then all the wah, 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 wah. And I got up when that meeting was over, and I ran out the door because I had needed first aid. And and I ran to my car and screamed because it hurt. And I went back to my mom's and dad's house. And the next week, I went back to that meeting just because I knew where it was. And I walked up to this meeting, I go into the meeting, and I go, "Okay," and I sit down, I don't get coffee, I went to college, I live, I learn. I sit down, and I'm looking around, and it freaked me out. This was a moment where I started a connection with God. And it was subtle, and it was disguised. And what happened was, I sat down in that chair, and I looked around the circle, and the same people were sitting in the same chairs. This was my first cycle. And that spoke to me because I'm a loser with nowhere else to go, and I had to get out of the uncomfortable place. And these guys are well-dressed, they look comfortable in their skin, and they're sitting here again. And I thought, these guys take this seriously. And I left as soon as the meeting was over, and I came back the next week right when it started, and my seat was still there, and I sat down. There they were again, reassuring. And then it went around. I don't know what step we're talking about. I'm not sharing. I didn't work the steps yet. I'm very happy to be quiet in this meeting. And one of these guys says this revealing thing, and I'm like, God, that's weird. These guys are going to jump all over him now. He said something embarrassing, you know, and in my house, that's open game. You know, I remember my dad dropped me off for school one time, and there was a girl in my class named Mary who had a glass eye. And he goes, what's wrong with that girl? And I go, she has a glass eye. And he goes, well, make fun of her. She'll get over it. It's Irish psychology. And I'm like, I'm not going to make fun of her. She's my friend. It's Mary. I love Mary. So I thought, we're going to leap all over this guy. We're going to give him, you know, embarrass him. He just said this thing. I can't believe he said it in front of all of us. God, that's so embarrassing. And then somebody else said something. Said, you know, I remember when that happened to me, but it was a little weirder, you know. I was wearing diapers. Whatever. And they were more vulnerable, and I couldn't believe it. And then everybody did something like that, and I witnessed the first time I'd ever noticed it. I'm sure it was all around me my whole life, but I witnessed spiritual love, healing love. There's a line, I don't know where I heard it, I read it somewhere, and it is Alcoholics Anonymous to me. It says, that which is received as accusation is abhorred and discarded instantly. But that which is understood through revelation is cherished and put to a lifetime of use. And all I've gotten in AA is revelation. This is what happened to me. This is what I was like. This is what I did. And I was stunned, and I was safe, and I was glad, and I was clean. I got a little cleaner inside, and all I did was go. I went to the meetings, and then I got a sponsor. I said, what do I do? And I jumped in, because there's the jumping off point, and then there's the jumping in point. Right? A lot of people jump off. And then I got in with these guys, and the way we do it is we read a chapter in the big book together, we discuss it, and we do the step. I remember my sponsor said, now we're going to get down on our knees on my kitchen floor here and do the third step. And in my head, I'm like, the hell we are? Like, all of a sudden, I realize I got Jeffrey Dahmer as a sponsor. I don't know him that well. We're only on the third step. And I get down on my knees. I'm holding hands with a guy. He's like right here, and we're saying this prayer, and I stood up, and you know what? I had a spiritual experience. I didn't even know it, and it wasn't like, oh, I feel lighter. Ooh, I gave my will over to God. What the hell does that mean when you're new? What does that mean? But I stood up and thought, I just did something I really didn't want to do, and I feel better because I want to get better, and that's what AA is like for me, and I want to tell you a couple of stories like that. Well, I was walking in with my sponsor one day into a meeting, and I go, hey, man, I don't think you understand this because you don't have any children, but I think I love Phoebe more than I love myself. I got like 60 days. I'm this diarrhea mouth sponsee. And I'm walking along and I go, you know, I thought it was the worst thing ever and it's probably the best thing. You know, I'm a sober dad and she's so great and I can't believe the connection. Blah, 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 blah. And he just walks right by me like, blah, blah. And I'm very insecure and emotionally needy and I'm in the meeting. And I'm looking at him thinking, I did not know he was deaf in his left ear. I didn't know that. So we walk out of the meeting and the puppy dog like runs up to his leg, you know. And I'm like, you probably don't understand because you don't have children, but you know. And he just turns around, he puts his hand in front of me, he goes, stop talking. And he said, Matthew, do you pay child support? Or how much are you paying? And I went, well, you know, I work at a newspaper from midnight to 4 a.m. I live with my mom and my dad. I drive a truck in the morning. And he goes, I know all that. How much child support do you pay? And I said, well, I don't pay any. And he said, then you're kind of full of it, huh? And I said, what? And he goes, why don't you not tell me that you love your daughter anymore? Why don't you just show me? And then you won't have to tell me anymore. We had this really quiet drive home.
I was plotting his death, and he was living in the present moment. And I went into Eric, and we had a pretty serious talk that night. I burned through a lot of Marlboro Reds telling Eric what a dick my sponsor was. And I'm walking around in a circle, getting all red in the face, walking around getting red in the face, thinking of my arguments. And then I realized I had a moment of clarity. I got one of those little jumping off points where I went, you know why I'm red in the face? You know why I'm mad about this? It's because he's right. I am so full of it. I wanted someone to think I was a good person. That's why I said I love my daughter. Who can argue with you love your daughter? Well, apparently my sponsor can. So I call up Anna and I say, Anna, I don't make much money, but I should give you some money. And she goes, oh my God, that'd be so great. I'm trying to go to college and this is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And I go, well, how much do you want? And Anna, very shrewd girl, she goes, oh no, let's not do it that way. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, let's do a percentage of your paycheck. She was betting on my horse. I thought my horse was lame, so I'm like, whatever you want. You can, and I'm never moving out of my parents' house. I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free in this back room with Eric for the rest of my life. That's what I thought. You know, when you're new, you don't know how your life's going to change. You just don't know. And she said this very reasonable percentage, and every 2 weeks I would go to that place. I don't know if any of you guys have them here in Oregon, but it's a place that has a sign out front that says, you're so lame, you got to give us part of your check, and we'll give you cash for the rest of it. And I would go in there and cash my check, and run over to her house. And every 2 weeks, I paid that money. Every 2 weeks. I didn't wait for a month because I didn't trust myself. And every 2 weeks, I paid that money. And you know why I paid it? I didn't pay it because I wanted to be a good father. That's a lie. That would be a lie. I paid it for two reasons. And one of the reasons was I never want to drink alcohol again. That's like the most important thing here. Not wanting to drink alcohol again. I don't want to drink it again because it takes me to hell and I'm a slave to it. And it makes me feel like a degenerate all the time. I don't want it anymore. And my sponsor made me kind of feel like I might. And the other thing that happened, the reason I did it that way is because the only spiritual experience I was having was holding Phoebe Rose my first year. I was a hollow desert. I was an empty shell pretending to be getting a spiritual experience. Because I wanted what you had. And I hadn't done the work yet. I didn't know where it came from. I was doing the work. And I would just hold that little girl. And she had no agenda. She'd squeeze my face and pull on my ears. And she was just amazing, you know. And she didn't have an agenda. She thought I was okay. So I paid that like my ticket to get in. And it was weird because after a few months, I walk into meetings and people would see me and they didn't jump up and applaud. You know, and I look in the grapevine going, where's the Matthew Pace child support? He's a hell of a guy article. I bought this damn rag. I thought there'd be a story in here. I was going to be more sober and get the grapevine. Remember that? And the thing was, nobody knew that I did that. And after a while, that became the most important part. That was the most important part. And one day, I'm sitting with Phoebe. I was about a year and a half sober, and Anna was going to go off to college. And I'm playing with Phoebe, and I'm like, Phoebe, I am your father. I'm going to be your father for the rest of your life. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten, baby. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade, second grade. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there with you. I'm going to get you a car when you're 16, honey. I'm going to, you know, vet your boyfriends. I'm going to save money. You're going to go to college. I'm going to be with you for the rest of your life. And it occurred to me that I loved that news, that I was so happy for my position in her life. And a year and a half before that, I had prayed a righteous prayer. And my prayer was, God, make it so these two women never see me again. And I did what you said to do. I did the actions. And I got a little bit of a root into my connection with my higher power that day when I realized I'd hit the lottery and that I wanted to be me. And I sponsor these guys and they bring me their 8-step list and their name's at the top of the list. Very awkward moment for us. And they say, you know, I put my name at the top of the list because I think I've hurt myself the worst. And I always tell them, you know what? I try not to be sarcastic. I go, let's put your name at the bottom of the list and then do all those other amends, and you may find that you no longer have to make amends to yourself.
Because you already did. They're all about amends to yourself. So I've got a few minutes left, and I want to tell you about some of the gifts of sobriety. One of the things that happened to me, I'm Catholic, I'm scared to death of God. Nuns. And one word, nuns. Not going to say anything bad about them. I'm just scared of God. And they are the witches of God. They wear the little outfits. And so I came to my sponsor with the 11th step, and I said, what the hell is this? Prayed only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. What is that? That's so ambiguous. You know, I've done these steps. They are tools for living, but I don't get that. What does that mean? And my sponsor didn't answer me right away. By this time, my sponsor was Bill, and he said, you know, I think you're thinking about this too much. Don't worry about it. So then we're in step studies, and I'm going to meetings, and there's this step keeps coming up that gives me the willies, man, because I think God's will for me is shame and punishment, and I earned it. And one day, I bring it up to him again, and he goes, you know, I've been thinking about that. He said, I think you just are thinking too much. He said, I think that when the alarm clock goes off, God's saying, get up. I think when a bill comes in the mail and it says, pay this amount, God's saying, hey, pay that amount. You know, I'm thinking when Phoebe's diaper's dirty, God's saying, hey, I think it's time to change the baby. He said, why don't you just do the next indicated thing and be pretty sure that you're doing God's will? And it seems so obvious. Like, it was like, I'm sure my father would roll over in his grave. I'm sure he tried to teach me this. And I just went, oh my God, that makes so much sense. You know? And I started doing that. And I got all these other jobs. I got these better jobs. I got this job at this airline. And it was great. They gave me a suit. And they gave me money to clean the suit, which was super smart on that point. Because that's not where I invest, usually. And I used to go and I'd park my car and I started making money. I'm paying everybody back little chunks of money here and there, going to 10 gazillion meetings a week. I'm going on panels. I'm trying to sponsor guys, but I'm a little aggressive, not having much luck. And I'm going to work one day and I buy a guitar. I buy a guitar on my way to work because I can. It's okay now, you know. And I buy this beautiful Taylor guitar, a Dan Curry model Taylor guitar. And I like to say, if you play guitar, you're jealous of me now. And, but that's okay. I have self-esteem. I'm good with that. And I take the guitar, and I'm just on time for work, so I run in. I put it in my locker. I go to work, and I keep looking. I don't know if you're guitar players out there, but I go visit my guitar in my locker. And I just pet the case, you know, because it's a Taylor. They're red leather cases. They're sexy, and they're gold. They've got gold fixtures. So I get done with this day at work, and I'm going out. Oh, the reason I didn't show anybody at work the guitar is because I got hired by the vice president who was in AA. And they didn't know what the deal was, because one day I was working there, and I'm doing my job, and I'm working, and somebody goes, this job is hell, isn't this job hell? And I go, this isn't hell, man, I've been to hell, this is awesome. And it went around like, don't trust the new guy. No. The vice president hired him, he doesn't drink, he's weird, dude. He likes this job. But you know what, I'd been the cool guy at work every time I lost a job. So I didn't mind being the not-so-cool guy. But on the way out, I took my guitar, and I wanted to show somebody. I wanted somebody to appreciate this great thing. And I live with my mom and my dad, who were kind of over the excitement about my guitars. And I go up to the employee bus stop at the airport. I turn to the first person I see, and I say, hey, can I show you my guitar? And this woman turns to me, and she's got this British Airways uniform on. She looks at me, and she goes, I don't look at strange men's guitars. And she gets on the bus. And I think she thinks I'm hitting on her. I think she thinks, boy, get over yourself, lady. I just want to show you my guitar, you know. And so I get on the bus, and unfortunately for her, we're like smooshed together. The bus is packed. And I got this guitar, and she's all pale. And I look down. She's got this book, Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis, which is a beautiful book about Christianity. And I said, oh, I've read that book, because I wanted her to relax a little. And she goes, well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? And I kind of started to shake, you know. And I went, God saved my life! And all the blood drained out of her face. And she was like, how do I disappear from this bus? And I'm like, Jesus, Matthew, calm down, you know. And so I kind of downshift, and she's like, well, I don't really know if I believe in God. And I go, I don't think I believe in the God. You don't believe in him. You know, and we start talking. And while we're talking, I think, gosh, she's really pretty. She looks like Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's. She's gorgeous. Right? And I'm comfortable. So that's a spiritual awakening. She's hot, and I'm still comfortable. Men understand. So then I got off the bus, and I walked down to the thing, and I'm very calm, and I'm so happy. We just talked about God. It's awesome. She's really cool. She's beautiful. She has a British accent. She probably knows the Beatles. So we get down to the parking lot, and I go, hey, you know what? Do you want to forget about this guitar and maybe have dinner? And she did not think so. She emphatically did not think so. She's like, all right, look at my guitar. I've read that book. You don't have to wait for this bus every night. And I was like, wow, wow. And I said, you know, no would suffice. And she walks off, and don't worry, Charlie's okay. And I walk to my car, and I'm really feeling like, wow, I kind of blew that. And I went home to my dad, you know, my 32-year-old self, and he was laying awake worrying about my mom. And I said, man, I think I just blew this thing. And I told him, he goes, that's not over yet. And I went back to work the next day, and I work all day, and I run to try to get the earlier bus. And my excuse was, I thought, you know, I'd had a spiritual awakening because I realized that I went to work the next day, and I didn't tell anyone she was a lesbian. Who cares? I'm okay. She's okay. It's okay. Whatever. You know, she didn't reject me. She rejected my gender. Very clear. It's all clear now. And I'm only kind of half kidding. But, you know, like I didn't have to say anything about it. I go to work, and I rush to the early bus because I don't want to see her. And I blew it. She's coming up behind me, and I'm thinking, well, I don't have a guitar. She won't recognize me. And she taps me on the shoulder, and she says, I think I was rude to you last night. I don't want to go out with you. And I said, yeah, you were really kind of clear about that. And she said, but do you want to have coffee? You missed this bus? And I said, we're going to have coffee so you feel better. And she said, yeah. And I go, I'll take that. You know? I didn't have high self-esteem. I just had like... And we went to coffee, and we talked until we almost missed the last bus. We've been married for 17 years. I converted a lesbian. Miracles happen here. Yeah. And you know what? I had a lot of amends to pay. We got engaged in less than 3 weeks. She proposed to me. Audrey Hepburn proposed to me. And she's not retarded or anything. She doesn't have a club foot. She's like, in fact, my dad, when I went to see her, my dad says, does she need a green card? Translation, she's out of your league, son. You know, we built this life, and I had to pay, like, I inherited money, and I paid back my amends with it. And my wife watched this life. She watched what we do. I said, honey, I know this would be great for the family, but I owe a lot of people, and I have to do this. And she said, you do what you have to do, babe. You know, and I want to tell you, we got married before my parents died, and we got married in Crystal Lake, Illinois. It was my wife's idea so that my mom would go home one more time. That's who my wife is. And I'll tell you, I was standing on that lawn waiting for my wife. We have a little house on this lake, and we're waiting for my wife to come out of that house, and I thought, I need a minute. And I walked down to this little pier, and I looked up at this beautiful blue sky with these white clouds, and I said, thank you, God, that this is the next indicated thing. Because sometimes the next indicated thing isn't a dirty diaper or a bill. Sometimes the next indicated thing makes your heart blow up in your chest with joy. Because I jumped in. And we stood there and we said our vows. And for a long time I used to joke, I wonder when she's going to wake up screaming and run out of the house going, oh my God, what have I done? And we had two kids of our own. And Rory came with me tonight, and Rory is a delight. I love Rory. And I was listening to Charlie, and some people who know me well know I'm really worried about Rory because I'm moving him at 16 years old up to Seattle. I'm leaving Long Beach, California, moving to Seattle. Yeah, you guys love it. Well, take care of my son. And I'm worried about it. And I thought, you know, I worked a third step. I've done everything I can to make him the man he is. I'm not in charge of this. I'm not in charge of this. He'll survive. And I just want to finish with this. You know, they say, don't leave before the miracle happens. And sometimes speakers come up, and we did not do that this weekend so far. And I know the speakers that you're going to hear, and they do not do this. Sometimes speakers get up at these podiums, and they said, I came to AA, and I got sober, and I did the steps, and now I'm the CEO, and butterflies fly out of my butt, and I have, like, the hottest wife. I got my kids are Rhodes Scholars, and yeah, got a beach house. And it's just so deceiving, you know. That's not what we promise you here. You know, if somebody comes up to you and says, everything's going to be okay, and you're new, they are lying. I can tell you that. They don't mean to lie. They mean to, and I'll tell you, I don't mean to, this kind of spoils the party, but, you know, I was married to my wife for 5 amazing years, and I came home and I found her on the floor. And she had had a massive stroke. Her carotid artery tore. And she lost a big chunk of her brain. And she lost the use of the left side of her body completely. And she is never going to be the same. And we've been married for 17 years. So for 12 years, because of a power greater than myself, I can tell you that I have been a partner to my wife. I can tell you that I am not bitter. I don't feel ripped off. I am not really graceful about it. I can tell you that living with someone that has brain damage teaches you about powerlessness every day. I was telling Lauren today, you know, my wife is so great. She's so great. And she found these pencils that said Sophie on it. It's hard to find pencils that say Sophie on it because everybody's got Sophia, you know, in airports and stuff. She goes, I found these pencils. They say Sophie on them. I'm going to buy them for Sophie. I go, that's great. Buy a ton of them. And she came home and all the pencils said Andy on them. And Sophie said, thanks, Mom. Because Sophie knows, you know, Mom's not all there. And I'll tell you what. I don't want another wife. And I know enough about the present moment to tell you that I don't want her to be different than she is. When I live in my perception, I'm screwed up. It's always going to be, or it never has been, or this isn't going to be, you know, future past, future past, future past. Reality is always perfect. And I'm a living example. I can tell you that I know that to be true from daily experience of doing that, of visiting the present moment. The 11th step, half-hour meditation every day, serious prayer has given me an inside that's clean so I can see her clearly. So two things. When somebody says everything's going to be all right, they don't mean that. They mean if you come here and do this stuff and jump in, no matter what happens, you're going to be all right. And that's true. That's really true. And the other thing is, don't leave before the miracle happens. And Eileen talked about it today. Or just, was that today? Jeez. Don't leave before the miracle happens. I came here and I was an animal. I pushed my girlfriend down a flight of stairs and I didn't think twice about it. And I dressed my wife every night. And I undressed my wife every night and every morning. And I feel privileged to do that. I have become a human being. And that's a miracle. Thanks.